Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 50 of Real Talk. Wow, 50 episodes. That's incredible. Thanks to all of our guests for coming on and all the listeners. Really appreciate the support. We'll have to do something big if we get to episode 100. You may be asking yourself, for those that are watching, why is Kirsch wearing a Baltimore Orioles shirt? I'm a lifelong Dodger fan. I talk about it on several of my podcasts. Well, my son is in Pinto Little League, Pony League, in the Pacific Palisades. We're the Orioles. I'm a coach and got to represent. We have a big game tonight against the Yankees. So already in my coaching gear. This week we have Adam Sigman and Jennifer Keith of Ethos Real Estate. We have a great conversation about their new platform, their new business, which focuses on affordable housing, creating public-private partnerships, how they've been partners for over 10 years and creating partnerships with municipalities and city agencies and delivering affordable housing, which is a much needed product to communities. I don't know Jennifer as well, but through a couple of deals, I've met her, and Adam I've known for over 10 years, and we've had some closing travel celebrations together, and both of them are just great people, and Ethos is certainly a company on the rise. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Adam Sigman and Jennifer Keith.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with Jen Keith, Adam Sigman of Ethos Real Estate. Jen, Adam, thanks for coming on. How are you guys today?
Doing well.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Well, for those that are watching on YouTube, both your backgrounds are beautiful lake scene. And then Adam, what's that? Is that a little surf poster there?
Yeah, it's the endless summer.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Well, I know, you know, we've known each other for many years. We've transacted together. We've transacted opposite together. Adam, you and I have had the privilege of skiing together, playing golf together. I don't think there's anything we haven't done together except be on a podcast. So I'm glad we're finally getting to do that. We'll start with Jen. Why don't you describe, you know, for my listeners who may not know Ethos, what is Ethos? And then we'll get into your history and background.
Sure. So Ethos is a company that Adam and I founded about 2 years ago. And really, we previously had worked together running a platform under a family office and had strategically pivoted into looking at public-private partnership and affordable housing, really because that's a very high barrier to entry space, highly regulated, very political, very bureaucratic. And felt that that was an area where we could still create a competitive advantage for ourselves, and ended up winning an RFP to do a project that ultimately became 100% low-income housing tax credits, and really got us up the learning curve on how traditional affordable housing gets financed and deep into the tax code on some benefits that could be used in privately financed affordable housing. And so we started a company that really straddled the two worlds, private market financed affordable housing, leveraging public-private, leveraging certain tax provisions, and really filling that space of the quote-unquote missing middle, where nothing was being produced. And so have raised some money, which we can talk about, to seed our company, and really, you know, are trying to fill a gap in the landscape where there's effectively infinite demand for our product. And it's a new product as far as institutional capital goes, but certainly one where we've been fortunate to hit the market right when that becomes an area of big focus for many institutional investors.
Yeah, I mean, you say indefinite or infinite demand. I mean, in over the last 2 years, obviously, and we talk a lot about this on my podcast, that it's been a transactionally challenged time. And I put an asterisk next to that with one exception, affordable housing. My affordable housing clients have been as active as ever. And so curious, we'll go to you, Adam, you know, how has the last 2 years been for Ethos as you're starting a company at a time where it was hard to do transactions, but you're in an asset class where transactions kept chugging along?
Yeah. It's not been easy for anybody, affordable housing sponsors included. There's a lot of liquidity from the agencies in mission-oriented transactions. And we're fortunate to have a handful of capital partners who are interested in putting out money today. We were lucky enough to close on a large deal with Goldman Sachs beginning of 2023. We closed another deal this summer with a group called Vistria, who's a great partner of ours as well. And our knock on wood, preparing to close on a large Bay Area deal with Bridge Investment Group out of Salt Lake. So we've got some really interesting capital that wants to be in the space. I think from a competitive advantage standpoint, we're in a situation where a lot of the transactions that were previously going to syndicators, those guys are sidelined. So that's helpful. A lot of institutional equity is sidelined. What we're really short of is just active sellers, right? As the 10 years continues to bounce around, I think there have been moments in time over the last 24 months where we all felt like things were going to stabilize and we're going to see a little bit more deal flow. And, you know, this last 30 days has been no exception. We're a little bit of a hot jobs report. And once again, treasuries continue to spike. So the capitulation still isn't there. I think our competitive advantage is as high as ever, but the abundance of supply to really, you know, I think Jen and I would love to, we'd always love to be transacting more and to really take advantage of this moment in time, but we need an active seller to participate in those transactions as well.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it takes more than two parties, but for sure a buyer and a seller to come together on pricing to transact. Are you guys focusing on buying existing product or will you also develop?
So I can jump on that one. To date, all of our deals have been buying existing product and converting it to affordable housing. That's where we've had our competitive advantage versus historically, you know, we were competing and losing to value-add investors who were able to outbid us because they were projecting significant market rent growth. But in a slow to negative market rent growth environment, we're able to be outbidding those buyers. But ultimately, we're very much looking to be in the what we're calling build to affordable business as well. Leveraging the same tax strategies that allow us to do the conversions. We're, you know, similarly looking at situations, particularly in LA, where, you know, a lot of people entitled properties and have marked up their land value and really can't trade at a basis where it works for us to build new. Obviously, with higher interest rates, the yield on cost we're trying to solve for is still somewhat elusive. But there are some really interesting programs that are being formulated in partnership with public agencies that give us some additional, call it public superpowers, to make these deals work. So I think in the near future, we're hopefully in a position to be able to acquire more land for new construction that'll probably be, again, in that moderate income range. But I think increasingly more attractive to investors who are happy to not have to reach for those top of market rents and, you know, have a more downside protected investment on new construction.
You guys both alluded to competitive advantage and, you know, we transacted, I was opposite you guys on one of the deals that you referred to, Adam, in the Baldwin Hills market a couple of years ago. And I asked my client, why did you pick Ethos? And you know, you had a competitive advantage compared to market rate buyers. Can you tease that out a little bit for my audience who may be unfamiliar, why you have a competitive advantage against market rate buyers?
Yeah, I think I can try. I think, you know, our focus on not really needing to push rents to make returns. We can borrow at more attractive rates. And frankly, we've spent many years, particularly Jen, building relationships in the public sector to allow us some soft financing strategies that ultimately benefit our investors.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the capital stack that is typical for your transactions, both public and private partnerships that allow you to do the deals that you've been doing and want to do.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, we buy deals very similar to any other institutional buyer out there. We have a dedicated source of GP capital. We can get into that, but we're partners with GCM Grosvenor and have a very significant GP co-invest fund. And as I mentioned, we partner with other institutional capital partners, typically, you know, anywhere from 95.5 to 85.15 deals. We'll leverage deals with typically agency financing, although in certain cases we'll use bridge financing, and that leverage will really be dependent upon our partner's aptitude, right? So some partners want, we actually did an unlevered deal this last summer, which was interesting. There were some significant interest rate movements that we ended up just pushing forward and keeping it unlevered, which worked for our investor. But typically I'd say 55 to 65% leverage, typically from agencies. And again, these are sort of soft financing strategies that allow us to just kind of get a little bit of extra juice on the returns.
Mm-hmm. Jen?
I was just gonna add to that. I think, you know, expanding on the relationship piece, oftentimes we do have public agencies or nonprofit ownership entities in our acquisition structure. And particularly if it's a public agency, you know, their process for selecting their partners is extremely rigorous. One of the big considerations that these agencies have is headline risk for taking on the wrong partner. And so, you know, it wasn't without a lot of forethought that we named ourselves Ethos. We're really trying to set ourselves apart as, you know, the private equity group that follows through on its commitments, that, you know, does have the social impact component in mind, that has a team that looks like the people we serve. So it's just, we've been very intentional in how we've built out our business to ensure that we can really deliver on our promise to our public partners and to the residences that are building. So that process of getting the partnership, you know, it was years of lead time getting to that. And I think I'm not disclosing anything that I shouldn't, but, you know, when the brokers take out some of these deals that they know are going to have an affordable execution, they first approach the public agency and say, you know, who would you partner with and who won't you partner with? And they only bring it to the groups that, you know, the agency is willing to talk to. So, and at this point, it's a fairly short list.
Yeah. Now, look, over the last 2 years, transactional, like we talked about before, transactional volume is soft. And a lot of it is because the institutions were on the sidelines. You know, they had a lot of money, but they were on the sidelines. The affordable housing deals that I have done were raised through syndications. And you guys have elected to go through a joint venture model. So talk about why you've elected a joint venture model in a market where it's tough to get institutions to come off the sidelines versus a syndication model where private parties have been more willing to transact during the last 2 years.
Yeah, I think it's relationship driven, right? Jen and I both got our start in the institutional world. We both worked for real estate private equity funds before linking up. These are where our relationships lie, and where we think we can be most efficient. You know, we made a very conscious decision in forming this business not to be two folks in a garage, sort of piecing deals together and playing for you know, a couple promote checks. We built an organization. We have 10 people, and four of which are very senior, 20 plus year industry veterans, where we feel like we can own and operate and manage real institutional quality stuff. Now, that does require us to get to a certain baseline of AUM in order to be a profitable venture. But we felt like as a business, we could, you know, take one of two paths, right? And the given our backgrounds, given how we wanted to operate our assets, we felt like we could do this in scale with a full robust team that includes, you know, vertical integration of our construction management and development experience.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have been partners for a while. Talk about, you know, your partnership, how you guys complement each other, and I guess a division of labor as you're attacking and executing on deals. Jen, why don't you go?
I'm happy to kick it off. So Adam and I met during the Great Financial Crisis in 2010. And he was, I think, employee number two at what became One West Bank. But when it started was just, you know, a couple of failed banks that had been acquired by a consortium of hedge funds. And principally in that pool of failed banks was IndyMac, First Federal, I guess Citibank pool, and La Jolla Bank. And at the time, I guess both of us had been working for West Coast offices of East Coast headquartered private equity firms. And I think within, you know, 6 months, it probably had 20 other former West Coast office private equity people. It's probably the best place to build my network that I've ever been sitting in. All those people went on to do great things. But for a moment in time, we all became workout officers and we did workouts on this failed debt. And I think Adam and I became friends there because there was a lot of posturing. It was a hugely humbling experience going from, you know, being an LP to you're sitting in literally a bank branch with a couple of boxes sifting through paper, trying to understand, you know, you just got a car wash and you're figuring out, you know, how to value a car wash or a field of almond trees. And you know, none of us had ever foreclosed on anything ever, you know? And so Adam and I think in that moment of humility became friends because I was like, I don't even know how to do this. And have you ever foreclosed on anything? And so we just started, you know, calling attorneys and collaborating. And I think we're just very transparent about what we didn't know, which was a lot. In this space. And it really built a friendship and a level of trust where, you know, so much of this business, you are doing things for the first time ever. Every transaction is so new and unique. And I think you really do yourself a disservice if you're trying to pretend like you know what you're doing when you really don't. And so that built the foundation for a really great friendship. We ended up at the Watt Companies together. And I'll let Adam jump in here in a second. And built up a platform there. But as far as division of labor, you know, it works out really well that I really dislike doing the things that he's really good at and likes to do and vice versa. So, you know, you'll find me very happily reading through tax code and zoning code and going to meetings at City Hall and probably less on the ski trips and, you know, raising capital. But it's worked really well. So I'll let you add.
Yeah. I mean, I echo all that. The single best professional decision I've made in my career is partnering with Jen. She's, you know, I think anybody who really knows her understands just just how talented she is. And we've been through a lot together. You know, we've had some wonderful opportunities together, including originally at Watt, we met with a business therapist. And during that time, which was originally something that the family offered us as a way to help communicate to various members within the family. And we ended up leveraging that knowledge to really understand how Jen and I really truly do complement each other in every single way. And I won't bore the listeners with, you know, which animal we are and which speedboat or whatever, but we really got to know each other that way. And, you know, the freedom that comes with a secure partnership in a way that I can actually really concentrate on my strengths versus always sort of up until that point in my career, I was always trying to mitigate what I wasn't good at. And now when I can just really truly focus on what I'm good at, there's a lot of freedom from that and really expansive in terms of my professional capabilities. It's been incredible. And, you know, we've gone from there, from the business therapist to working with a business coach who's a former Green Beret FBI agent and really understanding how to go from being deal people to people who operate a business.
Sure.
And no one I'd rather do it with than Jen. And it's been a really, you know, I think that a lot of our investors will look at the strength of the partnership, which has spanned over a decade, and really say that this is one of the reasons that they want to invest with us because of the partnership, which I think is very rare in this business.
Yeah. Well, the senior leadership absolutely is main component of stewards of capital before they allocate it to make sure that there is quality, you know, senior leadership. And, you know, a lot of us in the real estate business and me running a law firm, we are good at the underlining aspect of our job for you guys, you know, identifying real estate, executing on that business plan, raising capital, for me, you know, providing legal services. But what we forget is that we now have an entire organization that we are running, people underneath us that we're responsible for. The operations of that business that have nothing to do with real estate or law. It's just running that business, employment issues. So it's a different skill. So when you look at Ethos and you look at what you've accomplished over the last 2 years in challenging times, and who knows when, you know, things are going to be back to, I don't know if they're ever going to be back to a 2021 timeframe. I don't know if we even want that again, because I don't think that's healthy for any of us to be at that pace. But as you look at Ethos over the next 12, 24, 36 months, what's the goal?
Well, I'll start by saying, I think I'm incredibly proud of the team we've assembled. And I think that's probably what I would say is our proudest accomplishment in building this business is we've been able to attract some unbelievable talent to our business. And I feel like we have not even yet been able to like use everybody to, you know, put them in the best position to succeed just because of some of the market conditions. I'm hopeful that in the next 12 to 24 months, as maybe some of the volatility in the market shakes out post-election, or at least the uncertainty around the election shakes out, that we can really start putting in place some of the systems and processes that we've been formulating and sort of working out the kinks. I mean, to your point, you know, going from being a deal person to running a business is a huge pivot, and I'll admit, not my strength. Adam's really good at making sure that the main thing stays the main thing. And we've been really honing, I think, our process and strategy over the last 24 months when it hasn't been so wildly chaotic with new deal flow. But I do feel like we're at a moment where, you know, the floodgates may open on new transactions. And so my goal is just to really take that discipline that we've put in place and apply it and really, you know, transact as much as possible. When we are seeing more institutional investors having raised capital specific for our strategy. So that concern around, you know, should we have gone with LPs or gone with syndicators? I think we do have a great stable of capital partners who are specific to our business strategy, and being able to deploy that over the next, you know, 12 to 24 months is where I see our business really taking off. But Adam, feel free to.
Yeah, no, I'll let go of that. I think we're going to have a window of time here, and how long it is anyone's guess. But I think we'll have a nice window of opportunity to really build up our core AUM on our core business. And I think, as we alluded to before, we'd also like to put in motion our development business, which I think those businesses over time can be very complementary. We do see ourselves staying an independent sponsor. Never say never in terms of would we raise dedicated pool of capital potentially. But I think, you know, the there's been so much that's gone into this moment, right? In terms of, you know, the decade we spent with the Watt family, the investor base that we developed there, our new partnership with Grosvenor, and then some of the LPs we've mentioned. So getting our sort of core business to a point that we can operate our business. I think some of these deals, I think we're going to look back in time. You can't time the market, but and say we were really fortunate to be able to buy this kind of real estate in these locations at this pricing. So we're really excited about that. And we think that the development business, particularly the missing middle affordable development business, can be a really nice complement to that. We're really proud of our expertise. We built a lot of new product in other markets. And so leveraging that that skill into the Ethos business, I think is going to be something we're really excited about and to really have our own business, right? It's been a lot of years in the making.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned locations just sort of generically. I'm curious the locations that you guys are pursuing. And I'm asking it because my other affordable housing clients are less location specific than my market rate clients. So my market rate clients, they know exactly. I mean, they're either Sunbelt or they're Texas or they're Florida or they're west of Denver or they're upper Midwest. My affordable folks, clients, we will transact in cities I've never even heard of throughout the country, states that I don't necessarily, you know, would call hotbed destination growth markets, but for them, they work for an affordable housing strategy. Obviously, we transacted on one right here in a very dense area of Los Angeles, but where are you looking to add more assets in your portfolio?
So we have incredibly strong relationships right here in our backyard in LA, but as you know, with many other investors in this market, it's been a challenging time for City of LA with the transfer tax and sort of just overall regulatory environment. But you know, we have a very strong toehold in California generally. We just closed on a deal in San Diego. We're closing on a deal in the Bay Area, in the East Bay specifically. And we like those markets for affordable because of some of the growth trends, some of the income trends there, some of the demographic trends. I would say we're probably pretty specific in where we target. You know, there are a lot of different types of affordable strategies within the acquisition strategy. You know, there's, you can buy expired LIHTC deals. So that's one type of profile. You can do the conversion play. You can, you know, there have been the joint powers authorities deals. So depending on your flavor of affordable strategy, you know, you may be looking for different types of metrics. But we've been seeing a really nice sales profile in the East Bay. And by that, I mean, where there has been some movement on cap rates and we can get to a really nice yield on cost with the strategy there. We have, via our work at Watt, been in Salt Lake City for over a decade, which has been a really great market. When we first bought there, there were no institutional investors coming into the market. It was really seen, you know, as a almost tertiary market. Now it's, you know, very robust and a lot of institutional money coming in, but we've had relationships there for a very long time. And unfortunately, with all the market rate building that's happened there and all the in migration, they have an affordability issue too. So that's a market we'll continue to look at. Inland Empire has been very attractive. We have a lot of good relationships there. So I'd say, you know, in the near term, San Diego County, East Bay, and Inland Empire is where we'll be focused. On the development side, I think there are going to be opportunities coming in LA, particularly building on public land. But you know, that's something that's probably 12 to 24 months out.
Yeah. So it sounds like more of a Southern California play, Bay Area play, possibly Salt Lake, as opposed to shots that are throughout the United States that some of my other affordable housing owner operators are transacting in? And is there a deal size that Ethos is focusing on, or a range?
Yeah, probably most of our deals tend to be 50 million or above. You know, we're closing on a $100 million deal next month. You know, scale is better, right? And sure, we're actively pursuing a deal magnitudes bigger than that. I think, as you know, most of the institutional folks, and we look at it the same way, deals generally speaking take the same amount of resources. So if you can buy at scale, we'd like to, for sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Makes sense. I have many conversations with folks, especially when they're starting out. It takes the same amount of time to do a small deal as it does to do a large deal. And, you know, your fees and promotes are bigger when they're larger deals. And not to say that small deals aren't good. And sometimes people focus on small to mid-sized deals because the institutions don't play in that space. So there's not a right or wrong answer, but definitely it takes the same amount of time. You know, curious to get your thoughts as I want to wrap up and be respectful for your time here. You know, there is a obviously a need for affordable housing. That goes without saying. It's why Ethos exists and why so many others are getting into affordable housing. But when you're dealing, and I don't want you to talk specifics about particular jurisdictions and agencies, but my clients who have, you know, needed local municipality consent, whether it's formal consent or informal consent, not even on a development deal, but on an existing deal, they have been extremely challenging to work with, almost in an adversarial way, when my clients who are buying affordable product are looking to enhance the product, looking to make necessary repairs to have a better housing experience for those that qualify for affordable housing. And some of these municipalities try to take advantage of transactions to get certain benefits that have nothing to do with the asset at hand or the transaction at hand. And so I guess my question sounds sort of loaded as I ask it. I want to sort of ask more generically, how has working with municipalities been in trying to make a dent in a systemic issue of housing? Because I feel like sometimes government agencies have good intentions, but it's certainly hard to execute in delivering more affordable product to them.
I mean, I could talk about this for hours. You know, a lot of it goes back to Prop 13 and sort of limitations on creating a bigger tax pool for the public sector to just provide services in general. And for whatever reason, from a policy standpoint, housing has been tasked with solving not only the problem of providing shelter, but, you know, infrastructure, schools, roads, you know, all sorts of things get tacked onto housing. You know, oftentimes on new development, you know, you're dealing with, you have to provide jobs and community benefits and parks and, you know, school fees. And so, sure, you know, people ask, why is the cost of housing so expensive? Well, it's because it's sort of the vector towards providing funding for so many other things. And I think there is this public perception, and you know, I blame the media to a certain extent for this, around like greedy developers and real estate is so extractive and there are all these profits that are being taken out of the system, that there's just room to ask for more, that, you know, because it's so extractive, this, you know, project can just support it just because. That's sort of the narrative and sort of the perception at large. And I, you know, even anytime you're asking for some sort of permission from the public sector, I think it historically has been used as, well, now this is an opportunity for to ask for something in return. And unfortunately, you know, these projects, even, well, particularly when you're leveraging private capital, it's still a profit-driven investment, right? You're not, no one's doing this for free, just like other service providers are not, you know, grocery store isn't handing out food for free either. But when it comes to housing, there's just this idea that, you know, anytime there's a give, there should be a get. And the way, you know, we've dealt with this when we deal with municipalities is really to just go 100% open book. It's, this is the pro forma. These are the levers. This is how it works. And, you know, if you ask for this additional, you know, benefit, it becomes financially infeasible and you just have to weigh out what your priorities are. There's, you know, there is a cost to everything and someone has to pay for it. And at some point, if you tip the scale too far on part of the private, you know, investor, the deal's not going to happen. And so it's just really over communication and a lot of education, both, you know, to activists, to the nonprofit partners, to the community, to the politicians. I mean, a lot of the work that we do is really like running a campaign. You know, you're out there just educating people on how these deals get done, how we get paid. You know, here's the fee to us. We have a deal right now where we're making way less than the architect is, you know? So it's sort of just this idea of relative, you know, pay to the developers. We are also just a service provider in this whole system. And so sort of changing the narrative around the role that we play, and we're a facilitator like everyone else.
Yeah. And here you talk about all the things and nuances that go into affordable housing, whether it's an existing deal, still you need to work with the municipalities and of course a development deal. And I guess I'll end with this last question. So many of my market rate clients who have been frustrated in not being able to transact over the last 2 years have pivoted or added on affordable housing as a new area that they are transacting in. Similarly, in the office world, you know, folks not wanting to continue to do office, so they're pivoting into industrial. And so industrial folks see more competition. Are you seeing more competition in pursuing deals from groups that historically have not been in the affordable housing sector? And how have you been able to deal with that?
Yeah, I think it's nuanced, right? Because it's not always clear who we're competing with and what their strategies are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the execution of these business plans is really asset management intensive and nuanced, right? Dealing with this demographic, tenant profile, and frankly, oftentimes third parties can be, you know, more hands-on. Competition will flood to areas of opportunity. That's always going to happen. And, you know, one of the things we've always been able to do with our business is really pivot as needed. I think we look at where we're at today and I think we feel like there's green pastures ahead. So we're not looking so much side to side, but there's obviously a ton of wonderfully talented groups out there that we will compete with, and really, you know, we're relying on our great stable of capital partners to hopefully, help us win the bid.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I said that was my last question, but that was my last substantive question. So I would like to always end on more of a personal touch. And Adam, you know, we've known each other for a long time. We've traveled, ski together, and anytime I'm with you, I hear about, you know, these amazing trips that you go on. So I want to ask both of you, Jen, I haven't had the opportunity to ask this of you, but I'm curious of, I don't know, some of the best trips that you guys have been on maybe in the past and also that you're planning. So Adam, I targeted to you first and then I'll let Jen think about it while you're giving your answer.
Well, life's changed for me. So now I'm focused on my daughter and my business. So I'm really looking forward to just taking a week this summer with her in Hawaii. So that's where my focus is. I've had some neat opportunities to do boat trips in Indonesia and some, you know, some of that stuff. But today sitting here, I am most looking forward to being with my daughter in Hawaii. And it feels like it's been a long year and it's April 9th. So
how about Jen?
I'll give you a personal and a professional one. So equally, you know, but in my free time, I am, well, in my free time and not free time, I wear my mom hat. I have two boys. And I grew up in Germany. My dad was stationed there. He was in the US Army. And I still have family there. I speak fluent German. My kids speak German. So anytime I have a chance to take them back and see family, that's you know, an important thing for me to do with regularity. So that's a very special trip. We try and do, you know, at least every other year. When you started asking the question, I was thinking you were talking about sort of a professional trip. And, you know, the nice thing of being in a partnership for over a decade is that you can look back to where you started and then say, my goodness, we've come really far. And I remember, but please don't hate me for saying this, Adam, on the podcast, but I feel like these gems are worth sharing.
I can't
you know,
wait.
One of the first, you know, fundraising trips we took to New York, and I'll say this was a long time ago. We had like one meeting, you know, but we sort of emailed a whole bunch of other people and we're like, yeah, you know, we're going to be out in New York talking to investors, but we had like sort of one meeting that wasn't even a real meeting. And, you know, we used that meeting to sort of suggest, you know, we're here for all sorts of stuff. Like, would you like to meet for coffee while we're busy, you know, having 20 other meetings when we only had sort of this one like fake meeting. And you know, we were heading to New York in 2 hours and we're trying to like jam in all the real meetings and like fit them into a very, very full calendar. And every so often we sort of have to stop and be like, remember when we had no meetings and we had to like fake a trip to New York to like get meetings and pretend we had meetings to get meetings and no one responded to our emails. And it was just really, it was just us emailing each other. You know, we had nothing in our inbox. So, you know, I will say it was a great, it's with great pride that we're going to New York for a lot of real meetings. And we can look back and sort of laugh at, you know, how far we've come. But yeah, that's my professional story.
That is a great story. And the fact that you were just conjuring up these fake meetings to make it look like, oh, let's try and squeeze you in. I love hearing that. And it shows the growth of both you guys and previously at WAD and now at Ethos. And I have no doubt that in a couple of years, we'll do this again. And we'll talk about all the assets that you have under management. And it also shows that you can't just stay, you know, behind your desk in your living room or in your office. You got to get out there. And this is a people business. And, you know, sometimes people forget that. So,
that's right.
Look, I know you're heading to the airport. You're going to New York now for a lot of real meetings, not fake meetings. And so thank you for squeezing this podcast in on your busy schedule. And I truly appreciate you coming on and best of success to both of you and to the whole organization.
Thanks, Andrew. We appreciate you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.